Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for May 8th, 2018. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the host, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. In the news recently, there have been plenty of teachers' strikes, particularly in what are called red states. So my attention was caught by an article a few weeks ago titled, "The Corporate Plan to Groom U.S. Kids for Servitude by Wiping Out Public Schools. Our First World Children Being Trained for a Third World Life." This explains why teachers are striking so suddenly in several states and what the teachers are up against, both tactically in their immediate strikes and strategically in their resistance against efforts to undermine the foundation of the public school system that developed through the 20th century and through which we, your hosts, and most listeners surely grew up. So with us today is the author of that article, Lynn Paramore. Lynn is the senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking in New York City. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization founded in 2009. That's in response to the great financial collapse of that time, and dedicated to the rigorous pursuit of innovative economic theories and methods that address society's most pressing concerns. And I quote from their website, "Traditional economics is failing us. Our goal is to offer hopeful solutions to the key challenges of the 21st century." Lynn Paramore is a cultural theorist who studies the intersection of culture and economics. She is contributing editor at Alternet, and a frequent contributor to Reuters, Al Jazeera, Salon, Huffington Post, and numerous other outlets. Her first book of cultural history, Reading the Sphinx, was named a notable scholarly book for 2008 by the Chronicle of Higher Education. A web entrepreneur, Paramore is co-founder of the Next New Deal blog of the Roosevelt Institute, where she served as media fellow from 2009 to 2011. She's also co-founder of RecessionWire.com and a founding editor of IGOYouGo.com. She received her doctorate from New York University in 2007 and has taught writing and semiotics at NYU and has collaborated with some of the country's leading economists for her e-books, including Corporations for the 99% with William Lazenick, and New Economic Visions with Gar Alperovitz, who's a author some of you might recognize from being a guest on our program just last November. In 2011, she co-edited a key documentary book on the Occupy movement titled The 99%, How the Occupy Movement is Changing America. So let's look at teacher strikes as a response to the emerging two-tiered education system designed to benefit big business. Lynn Paramore, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, well, we're very excited to have you because these teacher strikes are going on all over the place, and they're really in the news and getting people's attention, and they're massive. I wonder if you could talk about the character of those strikes. What does it all mean? What is happening?
Yes, it's really extraordinary, this particular wave of teacher strikes. If we look back, it's not the first teacher strike that we've seen in recent years. We had the Chicago teacher strike in 2012, which received some international news coverage. So that was a very important one. But this current wave, which started in West Virginia, has just picked up steam and seems to be having a domino effect from state to state, and it seems to be focused in what we call red states, so-called right-to-work states, mm-hmm. And places where they're challenging often legislators, governorships, the complete control of the political system by often very hardline Republicans. So this is quite something. I don't think it's anything that the media particularly expected, maybe that the public expected, but it has its roots in actions that have been taken for a very long period of time. But in the short term, we can look back to the Great Recession of 2007-2008, after which there were drastic cuts, austerity measures, as I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, where education budgets were cut, and at the same time, corporate taxes were often lowered, and it, you created a situation in which, teachers were severely burdened. And just to give you a little bit of information on where teachers stand, public school teachers now face a 17%, what they call a pay penalty for being teachers. And that's to say that workers, college-educated workers in sort of, you know, similar arenas earn 17% more than teachers do. Now, in 1994, that gap was just 1.8%. And so the burden of all of these cuts has really fallen on teachers hard, and it's fallen more on the experienced teachers in many cases than entry-level teachers. And just to give you another figure, in the 1960s, teachers actually earned more than other college-educated workers. And this has been particularly, the budget cuts have been particularly devastating to women, because they make up 76% of the teachers in the United States. So women have been hit especially hard. And finally, after all the cuts and all the low teacher wages, and along with really egregious things that impacted the dignity of teachers, in West Virginia, for example, it wasn't just the horrifically low salaries and education budget cuts that finally tipped teachers over the edge to strike. It was something to do with their health care. In order to access their health care, they were required to submit personal details of their health, things like their waist circumference, their sleeping habits, really invasive stuff. They were asked to do this daily on a phone app. And that is what finally sent them over the edge, and they finally said, we can't take this anymore. This is actually impacting our dignity as human beings and our fundamental rights as citizens to privacy. So it's been a combination, a real maelstrom of things that has finally boiled over.
I don't know the details about that tipping point, by the way. So was do we know what was behind that, or what business interest was behind that?
It's supposed to create incentives for people to, be able to pay for people who are paying for insurance are supposed to exhibit healthy behaviors, mm-hmm. In order to access that. In other words, it's sort of the health insurance becomes a reward for good behavior. And this is just something absolutely outrageous. Mm-hmm. As part of the concessions that the teachers were able to gain in West Virginia, there is now, a task force dedicated to studying this issue and, hopefully dismantling it. Mm-hmm. But, it's just another penalty that teachers were asked to pay to sort of make really life as miserable and unpleasant for them as it possibly could be. And this, mind you, is in a state where the governor, Jim Justice, is a mining tycoon. He's a billionaire. And he was initially refusing to give the teachers any more than a 1% a year pay increase, which effectively is a pay cut if you think about inflation. The teachers, by striking, were finally able to wrest a 5% wage increase. It's important for people to realize it's not just about wages and it's not just about benefits. It's about a whole atmosphere of oppression, of teachers being called out as selfish and greedy, as they have been done over and over from state to state where these strikes are going on, the attempt to really demonize them. And it looks like the public is really galvanized on behalf of the teachers this time. I think there are a mixture of things sort of helping the momentum. We had the young people coming out and marching for gun control. I think even the Me Too movement may have had somewhat of an impact. Working conditions for women have been a subject of media attention. And these efforts to really change the status quo that have garnered widespread media attention and public support, I think are helping to fuel the momentum of these teacher strikes.
So could we say that in West Virginia they were victorious, that they actually won their case?
Yeah, they actually did manage to win a 5% increase. And, you know, the strike in West Virginia, the attorney general called this out initially, was unlawful. And that's why we call it a wildcat strike. Now, that is something that's an issue that has come up in other states. We may end up seeing a strike in Indiana where it's also the labor laws do not allow teachers to strike. But it just goes to show that when you push people far enough and you have enough people galvanized and enough support for, you know, mass collective action, it doesn't really matter in the end if the law allows it or not. People are going to do it.
It's amazing how contagious it's been. Can you talk about some of the different issues? I guess, of course, there's the obvious one of being underpaid and not only that, having your pay cut. And then this outrageous thing about monitoring your health every day. I had never heard that before. Are there other problems that the teachers are talking about?
Yes, you know, the cutting of education budgets has really impacted the quality of education that the students are receiving, the conditions in which they're receiving it. For example, in some places, students are having to go to school in buildings where there's not heat or air conditioning. They're using textbooks that are falling apart. Teachers' aides have been removed. There aren't enough counselors and school psychologists to serve the needs of the students. And in other places, teachers' pensions are under attack. So it's really a wide variety of things that impact the educational quality of life for the students and, of course, you know, the teachers as well. But whole communities are affected by this.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So why are you focusing here on public education? Of course, the strikes is what we're focusing on in particular, but you have written about the attacks on public education at the same time that this is happening. And why is this attack on public education particularly bad? I mean, we have take-backs happening everywhere else. Why is this one so crucial?
I think fundamentally an attack on publication is really an attack on democracy itself. It's an attack on values that we really hold sacred as Americans, values that have to do with equal opportunity, the idea that if people work hard and get an education, they can advance in life, upward mobility, and attacks on public education are really destructive to all those things, and it's really destructive to the idea of citizenship itself. People, of course, that can't receive good educations and end up in jobs where they have trouble making ends meet and they're constantly under pressure, whether it's from insecure jobs or unemployment, hardly have the energy left over to mobilize politically and to get involved in activism that would challenge the conditions that are making their lives so miserable. So it's a very, very fundamental thing to do with democracy and American identity.
Yeah, for sure. You made a really interesting point. I thought that people don't really expect to be given free health care or free food and clean water or anything like that, or they don't expect to have free housing, but they do expect to have free public education.
That's right. I mean, in the United States, as opposed to many other advanced countries, we really expect very little for just being here, for just being citizens, and, you know, in comparison to the citizens of other countries. But you're right. We have expected, at the very least, maybe nobody is going to help us with getting a roof over our heads and help us with medical bills, but we at least believe that our kids have the right to a decent education. And that fundamental right has been under serious attack. And, you know, the title of my article, which you mentioned earlier, about the effort to train American children for economic servitude, it sounds a little hyperbolic, but I think a number of scholars have recently been publishing books and investigators and are finding out that this really is not a conspiracy theory. It's not something that paranoia cooks up. This is documented. It's been happening in state after state, and it has to do not only with money and who makes money, out of this destruction of education, but a vision for American society that is very, very different from the society that most of us grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did refer to a couple of authors in your article, so let's take a look at a couple of those. One of them was, Peter Temin, is that how it's pronounced, by the way?
Yes, Peter Temin. Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called The Vanishing Middle Class, and that talks about unitary economies versus dual economies. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Peter Temin worked with an economic model that was created by an economist named Arthur Lewis, who is, by the way, the only person of color to ever receive a Nobel Prize in economics. And Arthur Lewis had looked at developing countries, particularly countries in the Caribbean, and noticed that they tended to feature what he referred to as dual economies. So economies on two tracks. Generally, in those Caribbean countries, you had cities along the coast with a more affluent population, let's say 20%, I think that's how he broke it down, 20% of the population. And for these people, life was fairly good. They were able to, you know, meet the challenges of life financially. They could have a pretty decent education, and the outlook was pretty positive. But for the rest of the population, the 80%, which was concentrated in the rural areas, life was very precarious, and they served as a cheap source of labor to these coastal populations. And it was very difficult in these economies that were on two tracks for a person to move out of the 80% into the 20%. So mobility, social and economic mobility, was very limited. The one thing that he found that could enable someone to leap from one part of the economy to the other is education. Plus a good deal of luck, because you had to have luck on your side. You might get an education and move to the city and something has happened in your industry, or there's some kind of economic crisis and you'd be out of luck. But education provided at least a possible channel to better your life conditions. Now, Peter Temin looked at that model and realized that it is now applying to the most affluent country in the world, to the United States. And he believed there's also a breakdown of roughly 20% of the population, which does okay. You know, people have pretty good jobs. People have health care. People can send their kid to an okay school. But 80% is in this precarious situation, and that ticket out of the 80%, which is education, is becoming increasingly scarce. And that's why education is really the thing that these dual economies really hinge on. When you inhibit the ability of ordinary people, of less affluent people, to get a decent education, you are really locking in severe inequality, and you end up with a country that does not look like the United States in the post-war period. It looks, you know, more like a country like Russia. Now, this is not to say that the United States has never had a dual economy before. We actually have. The slavery system, for example, was an extreme form of a dual economy, mm-hmm. and we had the Gilded Age. But in the post-war period, as Temin sees it, we were able to forge a unified economy that lasted, you know, several decades, and that it gradually began to be dismantled in the late 60s and 70s, and we've sort of seen that effort on high octane since the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of the comments in your article I found interesting is regarding Temin. He traces this to the 1970s and 80s when civil rights advances were making a lot of Americans uneasy, noting that from the end of World War II through the 1960s, the country began to develop a unitary economy, and the idea that everyone should have opportunities became more and more widespread, but there was a backlash, and we're still dealing with that backlash.
We are still dealing with that backlash, and you know, there's another book I should mention here that that I didn't refer to in my article, but I've also read with great interest, and that is a book called "Democracy and Change" by Nancy MacLean,
mm-hmm.
and she does some detective work, I would say intellectual detective work, and locates the beginnings of this sort of seminal burgeoning of thought of an intellectual force in the United States to an economist named James Buchanan, mm-hmm. who was from Tennessee and who worked at the University of Virginia and set up a think tank there. And his center was designed to study market-oriented approaches to policy and economics. Now, we're kind of more familiar maybe with a name like Milton Friedman, but McLean and others, Peter Temin as well, argue that this gentleman, James Buchanan, was actually fundamental in shifting to what you might think of as a extreme form of libertarianism, which Temin says you could almost refer to as anarchism. Now, those ideas didn't really take hold very effectively. Now, he was an early proponent of school privatization, I should mention. So the impact of his thinking on education eventually becomes quite something. But it was the events of the 60s and 70s when we had economic setbacks along with the increased power of minorities and the civil rights movement that really provided the opportunity for the thinking of Buchanan, which by that time was being applauded by people like the Koch brothers, to begin to attract serious attention and support. And the Koch brothers, for example, have been actively affecting kind of the marketplace of ideas, if you will, for decades now. Charles Koch helped co-found the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank. And the Koch network itself has just numerous foundations and charitable organizations and ways that they influence policy. And the interesting thing is that they have focused in the last few years, education and dismantling public education has really been the holy grail for them. That is the thing that is their heart's desire, to get rid of public education. In fact, I believe it was David Koch who ran for vice president in 1980 as a libertarian candidate, and on his platform, in addition to things like abolishing Social Security, his platform was to abolish public schools, point blank, abolish them.
Wow, the one ticket out of the ghetto there.
Yeah, I should mention that I did actually read that book 3 or 4 months ago when I heard it came out. That was one of those, 2 or 3 books in recent decades that I heard about and I went and got it immediately and read it. It was great, great read. Democracy in Chains, that's called, to listeners. By the way, let me mention to listeners also that we're speaking with Lynn Paramore, who's a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and the title of our show today is Teacher Strikes versus the Emerging Two-Tiered Education System, and we'll be taking calls after the bottom of the hour shortly, so stay tuned for that.
I'd like to mention another book while we're at it, just go off on a little bit of a tangent here. If you're interested in the history of shortchanging black students, of course, all these things that are happening to poor students or middle-class students, everything, you know that the people of color are going to get hit worse. And so there's a book out that came out in November by Noliwe Rooks, and it's called Cutting School. And she comes to the same conclusions that you do, although the book really deals with the history of education for black students in the U.S., she says that she invented this word, Sagronomics, experimental solutions to the so-called achievement gaps, including charters, vouchers, and cyber schools. And you're going to be talking about some of that for the mainstream students as well. But she notices the same thing that you do, that profiting from our nation's failure to promote a high-quality education to all children has become very big business.
Yes, that's very true. And while I haven't read the book, I've read some interviews with her and find her thinking very interesting. She highlights the role that Silicon Valley has played in all of this. And, they come in, Mark Zuckerberg and others, with these quote-unquote innovative solutions to a public education crisis that really doesn't even exist or has been highly exaggerated. And it calls for things like online education, more digital platforms, platforms. Well, of course, guess who benefits from that financially? Silicon Valley and the companies that produce these digital platforms and implement them. So that's a very important part of the story. And I think, you know, I think she also does a great job of sort of linking this back to 19th century segregation and the kind of Reconstruction era policies that blocked certain segments of the population from getting a good education. And that, of course, were black students. And now today we see, I would say, in the neoliberal era, which you could sort of see taking a turn in the early 1970s, the segregation is a little bit different in as much as it's not explicitly about race, right? We no longer say you're a black child and you cannot go to school here. We simply say if you're a poor child, you can't go to school here. You are not going to provide you with a decent education. So it's a kind of segregation that is hitting not just communities of colors, although it's hitting them in a disproportionate manner, but it is hitting poor students everywhere, and even middle-class students who can, who can no longer keep up.
Why don't we talk about some of the tactics to destroy our public education? You mentioned online learning. What's wrong with online learning?
Yeah, well, maybe just to back up a little bit, the efforts of some of these conservative right-wing entities, the Koch brothers being one of them, and another being ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a group that's backed by the country's largest corporations like Amazon and Bank of America. They have been involved in tactics that smash unions, that shrink taxes for the wealthy, and cut public services in general. And then their particular focus, as we've noticed, has been dismantling public education. And the strategic points in doing that, well, for one thing, they have tried to do it very stealthily. So they have tried not to draw attention to their agenda, and they tried to cloak it in language that is very confusing and obfuscates the reality of that agenda. But what you will see from state to state where they have been successful is a push for online education. Now in the state of Florida, you cannot graduate from a public high school without taking an online course. That's actually the law there. They want to lower accreditation for teachers. They want to replace public schools with privately run charters. They want to get rid of publicly elected school boards. And then there are some other tactics, but those are sort of the key ones that you see, a very focused, laser-focused effort from state to state. These policies have been pushed by business-backed lobbyists, and you have seen them have great successes in the last few years. So those are the things they're doing. They cloak it in anything from, oh, this is about budget cuts, we have to do this. Well, meanwhile, they're, of course, lowering corporate taxes and starving the state budget. Or they will say, oh, this is an altruistic effort to improve education. But again, the tactics, like in some places, they've been successful in increasing class size. I mean, you could ask a person on the street and they would probably tell you that's not going to improve education, or lowering the accreditation for teachers. These things pretty obviously do not improve education. But that's what they have been pushing. So they're altruistic explanations, certainly don't add up. So the question that many people have been asking, why in the world would businesses other than those that are going to gain in the short term, like those pushing online, the companies that make online education, why would Amazon, why would Walmart, why would the Bank of America, why would they be interested in widespread education failure? And that is something that was taken up by a very interesting book called The 1% Solution by Gordon Lafer, who is a political economist, and he came to some very startling conclusions about what's behind this agenda.
Yeah, it's very methodical, and it's really they know what they're doing, and I guess the rest of us really don't. So I really appreciate you being here, and I want to talk a little bit about, just for a minute, one of the things you said that was very eloquent, that it's the teachers who are putting the brakes on this campaign to destroy public education. So we really owe them big time right now.
Absolutely. I'm sure we'll talk more about this later on in the hour, but of all the things that people can do to push back on this attack on public education is to support the teachers in the strikes that are happening right now.
And apparently they are getting support from the public in the states where these recent strikes have been going on, and there's one or two continuing right now. Is the Arizona still underway?
In Arizona, no, Arizona, I think, well, I mean, when you say underway, they have gained concessions, they have gained, 20% pay increase over the next 3 years in Arizona, but they haven't gotten everything that they asked for, and I think there will be ongoing negotiations. Now, one of the things, the ugly things that is happening in a number of these states is the Republican legislature will say, okay, we will grant you more funding for education, maybe a raise, etc., but we're going to put we're going to dump the cost for that onto the least affluent people in the state, and it's a really nasty trick. In most places, the teachers have specifically asked that the increases in salary, etc., be paid for with increasing taxes on the wealthy and cutting corporate tax loopholes, etc. But that's not what these Republican legislatures are trying to do. They're trying to make it look like that, you know, anything we give to teachers is going to be taken from ordinary working people, from poor people, from lower middle class people. In several states, there have been there are things like increasing gasoline taxes, increasing fees for registering vehicles. You know, these are the kinds of regressive measures that really hurt the lower income people the most. So, you know, it's a bigger percentage of their resources. So that's the kind of nasty thing that's been ongoing, and there's going to be continued fights. And as far as what's coming up on the horizon, there has been some suggestion that we might get a teacher strike in Indiana, although striking is illegal for teachers in Indiana, but of course, as we noted, that didn't stop the teachers in West Virginia from doing it anyway. In my home state, I'm originally from North Carolina, and the teachers have been under terrible assault there for many years now with the Republican legislature that is extremely right-wing, and it's really sad because the school system that I grew up in Wake County, which is where the state capital Raleigh is located, really had a model public education system at one time. They were sort of a model for desegregation and very progressive. But that's all gone downhill. But the teachers in North Carolina are organizing a rally on the 16th. So it's not at strike level yet. But several school districts, including Wake County, where I grew up, and several other very large school districts, the one that encompasses Charlotte, the one that encompasses Greensboro, North Carolina, they have declared that May 16th, schools will be closed so that the teachers can have their rally and challenge the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let me remind listeners that we're speaking with Lynn Paramore, and we're talking about teacher strikes versus the emerging two-tiered education system. And if you would like to call in with a question or comment, the number here in the studio is 895-2448. That's an area code 707, 895-2448. And you just jogged my memory from earlier in the program when you mentioned the counties in North Carolina, was it, where you're from?
Yes.
And it just reminded me that the economist that you talked to, the libertarian fellow back in the 1950s, that is
Buchanan.
Mm-hmm. Now, he spent a number of his years at the University of Virginia, but I forget. Do I have it right? Fairfax County, right across the Potomac from Washington? Does that sound right? But anyway, the reason that sticks in my mind is because that was a very, very right-wing libertarian area at that time. But I think the trend there is toward becoming more blue as a suburb generally of Washington, which is something I keep a little eye on. When I see any news about that part of the country, I pay attention to it.
Yes, it mimics North Carolina in a way. North Carolina is often known as a red state, but I think it's a more purple state. Mm-hmm. And you have these counties like Wake County, where Raleigh is located, Charlotte, Asheville, North Carolina, which actually tend to be predominantly Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
So North Carolina actually went for Obama the first time around.
Mm.
So they are more purple than they are red. So I think that's part of why, you know, the Republican legislatures have really just gone too far. They've overstayed their welcome and overplayed their hand. And these are states, you know, Virginia and North Carolina, you know, it's not Mississippi, right? These are not mm-hmm. states in the Deep South, and they are states which have been justifiably proud of some of the advances that they've made in public education. The state university system, obviously the University of Virginia, very well regarded, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. These are centers of learning that are regarded highly throughout the country. And so it does end up having an impact not only on the state's economy to promote these drastic cuts to public education, but on the reputation of the state and even the the attraction for businesses to locate there, which is ironic. Mm-hmm. You know, all of this is being compromised by these attacks, which I think there's good reason, hopeful reason, to believe have really gone too far.
What kind of help are the teachers getting from the outside and allies? Are the PTAs supporting them? Who's helping the teachers?
Yeah, in many cases, the PTAs are supporting them, and even, you know, other members of the community, other professionals are supporting them. And perhaps the most important support that they're getting is from, in terms of keeping the momentum going, is really from the media. The media is, mainstream media is really paying attention to this. There are news headlines, you know, almost every day in the New York Times and the Washington Post. This has really captured the public attention. It's not going away. And it's really encouraging and I think uplifting the teachers in many states, where, like North Carolina, where they have just been burdened for so long. And I think many had grown rather hopeless about the situation. My mother was a public school teacher who began teaching right after Brown versus Board of Education. So she was there when the schools were being desegregated, and she's been just appalled and horrified in the last few years as to what's been done to undo the legacy of all these progressive educators in the state.
You just reminded me that that Supreme Court decision is the historic occurrence that motivated this this backlash that began with that economist Buchanan. And that is something, again, that is it Nancy McLean? Is that her?
Yes.
That documents in her book Democracy in Chains. The actual historic point where the momentum and the backlash began was Brown versus Board of Education in 1955, I believe it was.
Yes, he really was able to take advantage of the discomfort and the frustration that many were having, obviously, in places like Virginia mm-hmm. and Tennessee, which is where he was born, to desegregation. But he was very clever. You know, he was a Nobel Prize winning economist and a very smart, strategy-oriented person, and he knew that making the calls for privatization of education about race was not going to fly anymore. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't do that. He would argue that this was about freedom. This was about the freedom of states not to have the federal government, you know, kind of coming in and telling people how to run their schools. It was about, the intrusion of the federal government. And it was about the right, he would say sometimes, of people to associate with people of their choosing. And, you know, the desegregationist knew what he meant when he said that. He didn't mm-hmm. have to use mm-hmm. the word race.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, that kind of thinking was just something that it was a dog whistle, really.
Mm-hmm. So The public interested in education may all be tied up in classrooms this afternoon. So, but I'll mention again, the number here is 895-2448. And that's to call in and with any questions or comments about the topic today, teacher strikes and the emergency two-tiered education system, and our guest, Lynn Paramore.
Yeah, it really is interesting to watch the teacher strikes and then to have you explain that this is the surface of a very big battle going on, and it's I guess you call it a difference between a dual economic system and a unitary one. And,
yes.
And we need to understand how serious this is, because as you said, once you lose that unitary system that we've managed to glue together since the 30s, I guess, how do you ever get it back if you lose it?
It's really true, and you don't get it back very easily, and often it comes through terrible, bloody struggles like war, and I think that this is another reason that we should be supporting the teacher strikes, because they are peacefully challenging this threat to democracy, which the threat to public education really is, in essence. They're doing it peacefully, and, you know, sort of, you know, you want to say to these moneyed elites, we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way. There are much uglier ways that change can occur. Sometimes it only occurs through horrific events and catastrophes, but hopefully we can get it through these peaceful demonstrations and peaceful collective activity. And I should mention, too, that, you know, one of the really alarming things that Gordon Lafer concluded in his book, The 1% Solution, about these attacks on education. The title of his book is about a solution, and so what's the problem? The problem that the 1% is having is that with all the increasing inequality that they are engineering, there is increasing unrest and increasing pushback. And so in order to really protect themselves and protect their right not to pay taxes and their ability to, you know, make money completely unfettered by government and untaxed, they need to do something about that potential unrest. And he concludes that part of the vision in decimating public schools is to change the way Americans and their children really view their life potential. That if you can get them in classrooms where they don't have a teacher with appropriate credentials, or maybe they have mostly online instruction and it's of a very robotic, uncreative nature, you create kids who don't see great potential in their lives, and again, mm-hmm. they wind up in dead-end jobs and situations that are so stressful. It actually harms them physically. They end up with lower life expectations, but it also severely limits their potential to fight back.
You've also mentioned that Noam Chomsky sees these classrooms of now and getting more so in the future as control mechanisms.
As control mechanism, you know, if you have a digital platform, you just hit the button and there's your online course, you know, you're not getting the kind of socialization that comes through the normal process of education and the interaction with teachers. You really are being stymied in your creativity, in your ability to think of new ways to solve problems. And yes, he thinks, I had an interview with him recently at the University of Arizona, in Tucson, and he laid out, you know, a very dystopian vision of where this kind of education is going to lead us if we don't challenge it. And it was interesting, at the time I spoke to him a couple of months ago, we hadn't had the Arizona teacher strikes, and he was speculating on whether such a thing would happen. So at least we can happily report now that that there was pushback in Arizona, and that it was successful in many ways.
Okay. Steve, did you have something? Okay, we do have a phone call. Oh, no, we don't.
Yeah.
They gave up, I guess. Okay, well, please call if you would like to get your 2 cents in or ask a question.
895-2448, once again, is the number here.
Yeah, and this is really crucial information that we have, and when we do something as terrifying as this, we should also talk about what can we do about it.
Yes, what can we do about it? Well, One of the interesting things that's happening in some of the places where the teacher strikes have been successful, but the legislatures are trying to dump the costs onto less affluent sectors of the community and the society, people are gathering their efforts to create ballot initiatives that can actually raise taxes on the wealthy. So that's one thing that people can do. Again, supporting these teachers in their efforts is great. And I think also really educating ourselves, you know, reading books like the ones we've mentioned, Gordon Lafer's The 1%, Nancy McLean's Democracy and Change, Peter Timmons, The Vanishing Middle Class. All of these things can really help us understand what's going on and be able to see these efforts for what they are. You know, what might seem like, oh, we're doing an innovative experiment in online education. Wait a minute, who's behind that? What kind of lobbying has been done to push that? We begin to see through this agenda, I think, is so vitally important. And to also, we need to sort of understand as citizens, really, in the neoliberal era since the 1970s, there has been a pushing of a kind of mindset that everything should be judged upon the basis of markets and market-oriented behavior and market-oriented outcomes. And we've lost sight of civic values, things like fairness and equal opportunity and upward mobility. At the Institute for New Economic Thinking, where I'm a consultant, we have a series, a video series that's based on another wonderful book called What Money Can't Buy, which is by Michael Sandel, a Harvard philosopher. And he really talks about the moral limits of markets and the idea, you know, should only those who are affluent be able to receive a quality education? You know, we need to answer that question very, very affirmatively, that actually we as a society, it is our civic value that everyone deserves the right to a quality education, even if they are not affluent, that it's not only market-based values that determine things like health care and education, these areas where the market has really intruded in such a way that the quality of life for the bulk of people in this country is reduced to something like it would be in a third world country.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's part of the topic for the day here, you know, is that the fundamental belief that I've certainly grew up in and carry over from being educated and working in the latter half of the 20th century, and something I certainly believe in, but it's being, you know, undermined as much as it can with these other forces of, you know, commerce, finance, big business, and such. And, you know, we're trying to look out for it. It's there.
People are such suckers for the words tax break. I can't believe it. I think that's something that people need to think about, too, is why are they doing this? Is it to, you know, to close the schools?
There was a headline just in the last few days, and now I forget it. I think I have it open in my computer, but there's some red state legislature or a few legislators who have said, you know, we need to raise taxes to pay for this stuff. You know, some of this, I don't know if it was teachers or what, but it was newsworthy that anyone even said that. So it was someone in the conservative part of a legislature somewhere saying, you know, that this has gone too far. We need to raise taxes to pay for as much government the people are wanting. So,
of course, the answer for many of those in the conservative side of the spectrum is raise taxes on those who can least afford it. Right? It's not raise taxes on the wealthy or not raise taxes on corporation, and that's the problem. They want to put the tax burden on less affluent people, and I think that's one thing we really need to just wake up to as a country. Our tax burden, especially for the affluent, is relatively low compared to most of the advanced world. Mm-hmm. And there's one economist that I've spoken to, Lance Taylor, who's indicated if we really want to get serious about preserving the things that make this country function, our infrastructure, our education, etc., we need to be talking about tax rates for the wealthy at 50%. Now, that is not even what Scandinavia has. That's still lower. But we're really, and we have had tax rates higher than that in the United States.
Oh, yes, yes.
Decades ago.
Yeah, post-war period.
Yeah, exactly. But in recent decades, we've been sold a line, you know, that you can cut taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and it'll all, everything will trickle down nicely to the less affluent, and everything will be fine. And I think that, you know, the Great Recession and other events ought to have disabused us of that notion. That simply doesn't work. And our policies, unfortunately, are lagging behind because not just the Republicans, but unfortunately the Democrats as well have been too tied to, you know, raising money from those very people who want to insist on keeping their taxes low.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to push back against that as citizens and make sure that the people that we're voting for and supporting are not simply beholden to corporations and the wealthy, that they are beholden to the public, which is who they're supposed to be beholden to.
Well, that's an issue that the public can tune into as they look at developments in the primary campaigns, particularly in the Democratic Party and to a lesser degree in the Republican Party primaries. But that's where the populist candidates versus the corporate and well-financed candidates are duking it out. And it's happening right now. So and heating up. We have a primary here in, what is it? Well, it's a month. It's early June. So we're starting to see some signs of that.
And we're seeing exciting developments, you know, in California and other places where, you know, the more progressive candidates are getting substantial support. And really, you know, those who support the status quo are on the defensive. And I think the campaign of Bernie Sanders was such a wake-up call to the country.
Indeed.
It was proof that someone without backing from these wealthy interests could mount a very serious and effective campaign even without the appropriate support of the Democratic Party, and in fact was thwarted in some ways by the Democratic Party. So even with all that, he managed to win states in the primary that no one ever expected him to win. And you know, we ended up with an outcome in the presidential election that many Americans are very upset about, but the news isn't all terrible. You know, we did have this phenomenon that you can be a serious candidate without being beholden to wealthy interests.
Okay, we're going to take a call. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for this show. It's real interesting. I'm fairly well informed on this, and I have a couple of observations I'd like to make and then get your guest to comment on them.
Alrighty.
The first and foremost is that most of our politicians from both parties have endorsed and supported this move to privatization. And there's two parts to privatization that's really important to recognize. The first one is that there's an enormous amount of tax money that goes into education in this country, and someone would like to make money off of that. And they, you know, the market is profit-driven, and so people would like to make money off of education money. Unfortunately, when they do that, they go to minimizing costs and maximizing profit, and that doesn't produce a good education. You can see that by the privatization of the prison system and also some of the private colleges that have done that. And then the other thing I would like to point out is for the politicians, it's a move to reestablish, privatization would reestablish the old patronage system, which is means that you get a government contract and you kick back a certain amount of that money to whoever gave you the contract. And so those are two, I think, very big important aspects of the privatization.
Okay, thanks for your call.
I think Go ahead. Oh, I think the caller is really spot on, and this the comparison he makes to the privatization of the prison system, I think, is especially something that deserves more scrutiny and attention. Peter Temin actually talks about this in his book, that has effectively cut channels for people to move out of one sector of the economy to another. And now with the decimation of public education, it's going to happen on a wider scale. But yes, we have absolutely seen in that case of the prison system the terrible effects of putting these systems in the control of private entities who are, you know, out to fill beds in a prison and keep people incarcerated for as long as possible. It's had an absolutely detrimental effect on our society, and particularly on people of color.
Okay, we're going to squeeze in one more call. Hey, turn off your phone if you want to be on the air. Turn off your phone if you want to be on the air. You are on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me add a point. Something that I saw on the chessboard. You were mentioning that there's a lot of education is going online.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I noticed that the repeal of net neutrality is going to make that information more or less accessible to certain people.
Uh-huh. Okay, do you have a comment on that? Thank you so much for your call.
I think that that is certainly a related topic. And, you know, if we aren't able to keep net neutrality, it will certainly lower the access of lower income people to what's available online, and undoubtedly this would have an impact on classrooms in which students become increasingly dependent on online education, particularly in places where there are few resources. That's a good point.
Yeah, that reminds me of something you mentioned earlier about the requirement in Florida that every to graduate from high school and have your degree, you must have taken at least one online course. Well, how do the poor take those online courses?
Yeah, it's really quite something. You know, I can actually go back to my college experience. I went to the University of Georgia as an undergrad and encountered my first ever online test, or I guess it could, well, not online, so this is in the early 1990s, I guess it was just a computerized test, a math test, and there was a little clock ticking in the corner of this computer screen, and I had a complete anxiety attack, you know, just watching that clock ticking as I was trying to answer math problems. It was absolutely awful. It's the only time I made an F on an exam my entire college experience.
Well, thanks for admitting that.
We are.
Yeah, so there's real research that says, and it's documented, that online education, you know, at best doesn't seem to be superior to you know, normal human instruction, but in many cases seems to be quite inferior.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention, listeners, that some of your work, then, is available online at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and that is at www.ineteconomics.org. So that's INET for Institute for New Economic Thinking, economics.org.
Yes, and we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We should have you back to talk about some things you said in the past, like we don't fear the rich. We should fear the one-tenth of a percent of the 1%, the super rich.
Yes, so there's super another rich. Story there for sure. And thank you all to bringing these topics attention. This is so important, and I just think it's been a great program. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, pleasure to talk with you, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on 2nd and 4th Tuesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. here on KZYXNZ. The next edition of Corporations and Democracy will be in 2 weeks. That's May 22nd with host Linda McClure, and that'll be a pledge drive program. Andy and I will return on Tuesday, June 14th. And for further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of our democracy, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. And thanks for listening.